Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You think about the person in your life when you started believing you more than anyone else. They're the ones that make the sacrifices. When I walk out, my old man's next to me. They're not just looking at you, they're looking at what made you. I want them talking about our fucking game. I want them talking about us.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy and our near post-zonal blocker, it's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Yeah, that's me. I meant to head it towards our goal, right?
Yeah, I think just get anything on it
anything
is the
on
rule
it.
Of thumb.
So it doesn't matter if I'm the wrong side of the ball. That's fine. Yeah, cool.
Sweet. Absolutely fine. Yeah, yeah. That'll do. Thank you to the following for their emails over the previous few weeks. Very much appreciated. So Zach Frank, Jeff Fieldend, Ben Lacey, Joel Hooten and Matt Hooten, Aaron Lickstrahl, Ben Bernstein, Keith Starr, Colin McInerney, Matt DeWild, James Sullivan, Davis Trujillo, Bradley Lewis sent us a lovely email as well. Thank you all so much. Very much appreciated. Really enjoy the correspondence of our listeners. Less so over the weekend, though. I think I woke up to 12 emails about how shit we were against Arsenal this morning. There were more yesterday. Yeah, it's been a proper slog to get through those. Really brought me down. Let's start with Bardi. Bardi, you seem to have had a very calm take on this game.
We were just you screenshot my tweet so you wouldn't forget to bring it up, and I looked at it and it was posted at 2:38, and I said to myself, I wonder what time Arsenal scored their third goal, and it was on the 38th minute. So 100% that was a calm take at a moment of pure tranquility in my mind. So yeah, I didn't specify who I want out. So people just assumed it's Ange. It could have been Jedinak. It could have been that albatross Ryan Mason, who I really want to get out because everything comes back to him. It could have been our goalkeeper. It could have been our cement mixer. People obviously are a bit touchy and they thought I meant Ange. It says more about them than it does me, to be honest.
Vicario does need to go and collect the ball from the edge of the 6-yard box sometimes. To be fair. Yeah.
Do you know what?
That would be nice. So, yeah.
While we're here, it could almost play. Almost, if Vicario was a bit more proactive, a more proactive goalkeeper, maybe. Yeah. Anyway, let's carry on.
So, Bardi's tweet was at 2:38 on Sunday. He's got to go. We got a lot of correspondence about this tweet, which I've been fending off the last 48 hours. So little summary of some of the correspondence. Tim Hopkins said, yes, I know he walked it back, but only slightly later on. And I love Bardi. I appreciate how he makes the pod a more rounded experience for the listener. But convince me this isn't an overreaction in the extreme. Declan Hayes says, I know that Ange is not above criticism and emotions run high during the match, but this feels like a ludicrous take to me. I love Bardi and the takes he brings to the pod, but I cannot understand his negativity towards Ange, especially in year one. And then he goes on to say about where Arteta was a while back and where he's got now. Cooper said, this, the tweet, is pitiful. Richard Joy said, I think the thought process is one thing, putting it out on Twitter is another. A genuinely smart and thoughtful guy willingly joining the vocal idiots online that make our fan base so toxic right now was pretty disappointing. I'll add that I'm sure there'll be a much more sensible discussion on the pod. It's much easier to tweet nothing and all that. Gregory Cohen said, please, please don't let him off the hook, meaning Bardi, of course. And then we have a completely opposite view. This is from Matt Harkins. Okay. Who says, I want to weigh in on the Bardi hate with a critical intervention. The people who want Bardi to call it on the Ange hate are out of bounds. Mm. What they don't understand is that he is a negative dialectician, a la Nietzsche, Adorno, and Dimitar Berbatov. His job is to keep the tension, to heighten the contradictions, rather than bring things to a resolve. It is, unfortunately, the Anglo-American obsession with empiricism that prevents some of your audience from recognising this. His negative dialectics make the podcast worth listening to. They distinguish the show from other options that are often hours of unearned PR for the club's board of directors. I'm a more astute observer of the game because of his perspective, even when it is limited. Case in point, Bardi helped me see that the case against Postecoglou is presently unripe. If the main criticism of Postecoglou is that he can't make game-changing tactical adjustments, then it's too early to turn on him. He said himself that this phase of his tenure is devoted to drilling his style into the players. He sees tinkering as at odds with his goals. So those who think they're observing a deficiency in tactical adaptation are mistaken. What we're really seeing is something we're not used to. It's been a while since we've had someone who wants to stick around a while. Postecoglou was taking a results ambivalent approach to build something fundamental. It might be fundamentally flawed and he might suck at making adjustments, but it's not possible for us to make that determination yet. Again, these are things that are difficult to grasp for empirics obsessed Anglo-American minds.
Under the Adornoist perspective, something is provided for all on this podcast so that none may escape.
Very nice. Very nice, Nathan.
Can I leap in once more? I just want to say that I kind of made that defense of Bardi last week, saying how good it is that we have him on this podcast. And I also want to say, what are you on about, mate? Come on.
What I'm on about is we're watching a North London derby where all that matters really is stopping them. We just have to stop them from winning the league. And it's in our control. We're not finishing top four, not anymore, with how the results went on the weekend. So let's all up. We exist last Sunday, we existed solely to stop them. And they just wandered through us. And in 38 minutes, we're 3-0 up. They didn't do anything special. They didn't do anything clever. They didn't do anything clever, which is what upset me the most. We were 3-0 down to a team that just turned up and got out on the pitch. And that was where the anger came from. It was great to see a second half rallying call, but by then it was too late. But it was the fact that Arsenal did nothing to warrant being 3-0 up, yet found themselves 3-0 up. That's where the disappointment and the anger came from.
I get that from like an emotional perspective. I totally get, because like I feel fine now. But yesterday fucking stung for multiple reasons, mainly the fact that we've prevented them, you know, we failed on our part to prevent them from potentially winning the league. Or the other aspect of that that we'll get into is the feeling of injustice from this game, which we'll get onto later. But so I get the emotional feeling, but it also, it's just not Ange's fault that Arsenal are good right now, you know?
No, it's not. And I'm not sure, like, the last time Arsenal won the league at White Hart Lane, I remember it vividly. I was old enough to remember it. I was at uni at the time, and it that really hurt. And that was in an age before social media. When they did it in the 70s, I wasn't even born, so it didn't matter. But I remember that moment. And if Arsenal go on to win this league, which they might, they've got a good chance to do it, they will continually refer back to this is the game where they won the league. And all we had to do was just Jose Mourinho it. Just stop it. Just become a sleeping policeman and just stop it. A 0-0 draw. Stink the life out of the place. And all of us would have left that stadium happy at what we'd achieved. And it was the fact that we didn't do that and we let it go so badly, and they were mugging us off for a long period of time. And that's what really burns as a football fan, having to endure that in person. And that's the anger. And am I still as angry? No, it's subsided because life and everything else is more important. But I was, at that moment, all I gave a shit about was stopping them, and we just were so pitiful in trying to do that.
I disagree in a number of different ways. I think what you're asking for is completely unrealistic. You know, you want Ange to coach a team to do something that he has categorically never done in his career, and do it effectively against one of the best teams in world football at the moment. It's unrealistic. We, like, if you ask this team to defend their own box for 90 minutes, they will fail. I think we did what the only thing we could do, which is to play to our strengths. And I thought broadly we did it well. However, there is a critical failing at the moment with this club that undermines all of the good work, in my opinion, and that is set pieces. And, you know, how many weeks have we been saying this for? Weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And it might be that there are no immediate solutions in terms of personnel, although, to be honest, I think Bentancur may well have been picked as one possible solution. Mm-hmm. It might be that simply devoting more time to defending set pieces on the training ground is not possible because we're still trying to establish the attacking approach. The
they did have the 2 weeks
methodology.
They did have 2 weeks to
yeah,
set
sure.
up
exactly
to
I,
play
I,
the
I,
best
I,
attacking the best set piece attacking team in the league. I'm not asking them to stodge up the midfield and park the bus, but they know okay. Arsenal's main way of breaking down a game is via set piece. So you've got two True. Weeks. Just I don't know how many percentage of time you're going to commit to it, but commit 2 days. 2 days we're going to do nothing but corner drills and stopping the near post. And
yep.
I agree. Postecoglou, a manager's going to live and die by their philosophy. That's fair enough. They're going to throw themselves on their sword. That's his beliefs. He's not going to park the bus, but I do ask of him to at least master a basic art of football. I'm not asking him to park the bus. I'm asking him to master defending a corner, and he had enough time to do that.
I agree. I think this will be Ange's undoing unless he does something about it. So we got rid of Gianni Vio, and immediately our own attacking set piece productivity dropped. So I think we have no choice but to hire a set piece coach of some variety in the summer, because if you can't stop them going in at one end, the least you can do is try and score some at the other. Yeah. And in fairness, Romero hit the post in this game from a set piece. But I do think it's inexcusable that we concede two really simplistic set piece goals. You know, Nathan literally recorded a video, bless you, Nathan, in the middle of last week about our set piece defending. And, you know, I'm not going to give away the conclusions too much, but I think there are solutions. There are possible options. You can give Vicario more space and more responsibility, or you can essentially pack the 6 yard box and have two players on the goal line, like one at either post. I don't think we did either. I think we failed to do either of those things. And, you know, we're just watching this concede from a set piece against a team like Arsenal, who we know are really resolute in defence, felt quite soul-destroying, particularly because, in my opinion, in open play, we played really well in this game against one of the best teams in the league.
Somebody in Beaver Town.
I wouldn't go so far as really well, buddy.
Sorry, I was going to say, somebody in Beaver Town. Now, that's never normally the kind of hotspot of sensible takes post-game. But somebody said the sale of Kane has hurt us more on our own defensive corners than actually anywhere else. Because
yeah.
Kane, that was Kane's spot, no? He used to stand on the near post and just yeet everything mm-hmm. away. So maybe we do just need to buy a massive number nine and just stick him there.
Well, Richarlison was playing that role really effectively at the start of the season as well, which I think was one of the reasons why we didn't concede so many in the first half of the season. He was a very effective near post screen. In this game, we used Pedro Porro. I think that is a poor choice. I do think Bentancur was selected partly because of his height, because we know Arsenal are the best team, or maybe the second best at set pieces in the league, in the Premier League at the moment. So I do think that sort of factored into the selection of Bentancur, but it wasn't enough. Like, they just mismatches all over the penalty area from set pieces, but the strategy, I think, was not good either. Nathan, sorry, I interrupted you earlier.
Oh, I have no idea. Sorry. That's not your fault.
So we had a couple of questions about set pieces from Palab Ghosh, who said that Postecoglou's denial of there being a defensive set piece problem beggars belief and is doing him no favours. It seems almost Orwellian, making out the black is white in the hope that we believe it. And Daryl Brugink said, do you think Ange will finally wake up and realise he has a set piece problem? Why doesn't Vicario just keep his hands on obstructing players and shove them out the way when the corner is taken?
I I want to talk about this quote, but I think that that is a misinterpretation of what he said. Do we have the quote down here? Alistair Golds, framing from his tweet, asked Postecoglou if he now acknowledges there's a bigger issue with Spurs defending set pieces this season. And says no, because it's understanding where you are as a football team. If I thought fixing defensive set pieces was the answer to us bridging the gap, then I'd put all of my effort into that. But that's not where we're at. For us, it's about, when I was focused on the details of, not just set pieces, but a lot of moments in games where we don't see the sense that you give good opposition the time and space to do things. They're not going to hurt you. I think they maybe had 4 attempts on goal in the first half and they conceded 3. I don't think it's about one part of it. I think it's bigger, broader picture than that. But our defensive set pieces for those two were very poor. So it's not that he's failing to acknowledge that we're bad at defending set pieces. It's that he's failing or disagreeing with the idea that that deserves a lot of attention and focus right now. And this frustrated me. This quote frustrated me. But I'm also sympathetic to it for a couple of reasons. One is that, like, he is kind of right in the sense of, like, the most important thing is instilling the fundamental way that we play football, establishing that as a ground. Open play is more important than set play in football. The first year, especially in the first 2-3 windows, are building towards something rather than, like, what can we win this year, right? And I get that position. And the second reason I have some sympathy is because this is like exactly how I used to think about set pieces back in the day. But I just don't think this is true anymore. There's a good graph posted. It was from The Athletic. I don't know who it's originally from or what the context was, but showing that back in 2008, you would get 2.7 goals per 100 corners in the Premier League back in the day, and now it's at 4.3 this season. Right, they've doubled nearly in how high a return they are and how important they are in the game. The truth is, right now, set piece goals are costing us points games. And so, yes, he's right that they can't be the main focus right now, but he's wrong that they won't bridge a gap, because I think that going from being a bad set piece team to a good set piece team can move you 10 points, can move you 2 places up the table.
It could win Arsenal the league this year.
It may well win Arsenal the league this year, unfortunately, right? And yes, we are not at that stage where we're like, okay, what's going to get us over that line? But we feasibly could be. At some point, we have to address this. It is a considerable weakness right now. It is costing us games right now. Like I said, I think it's worth a couple of places in the league. And if that's the difference between fifth and third, third and first, it's a really fucking big deal, you know? Or even if it's only one place, it's a really big deal. So again, sympathetic to it's not the most important thing. It certainly feels like it after a game like that. But it is important. It is worth putting time and energy to. And if you feel like it takes too much time and energy away from your focus, then get a fucking specialist in. Take it out of your hands. You have to fucking worry about it so much.
Yeah, also, exactly. And also, it'll be more efficient if you're using a specialist.
And it's not like our attack or our midfield is so well rehearsed now or improving all the time that it would just alleviate some of the stress and the pressures on our forward line and our midfield, because the chance creations or the things we were doing, they don't seem to happen anymore. And it would be just a nice little help for us. Because the one thing, the Saka corner, so the my favourite's own goal, where I sit is right behind Saka, and he was getting some real abuse, and he stepped up to take that corner, and when he hit it, everybody that was my side went ah, because it was so bad, he hit it so flat, and then somehow, I don't know how, somehow it was in the back of the net. It was such a bad corner. And it wasn't even like, you know, sometimes you see a corner whipped in, you go, oh, that was a good one. That you can't defend against that one. It's just like Spurs, we can't defend against any of them.
Do you want a little bit of corner analysis for this game? How they scored both their goals, it was the same way. So Spurs, in my opinion, now over-focus on a zonal defence of the near post. We put like 3 players over that way, 4 players even. And also maybe too much too close to the keeper. But anyway, there's a long history of why we defend in that way. And Arsenal overload the back post, which is an area that we don't put that much focus on, which is, you know, a bit spooky because, oh, what's going on over there? Let's put some players over there. And then as the corner comes in, they all rush to the near post so that they are coming in blindside of the defender there. So they can't see them approaching. They don't know what angle they're running at. The Arsenal players have momentum and a run up into their jump. And so for the third goal, it's an Arsenal player directly jumping all over the man, whoever it was, I don't even care or know. And then obviously in the first incidents of the first goal, a shove in the back of Højbjerg makes him score an own goal because he doesn't know what's coming or where he needs to be.
He's also totally the wrong side of the player. So he's kind of like sticking his head across. Yeah, instead of the other way.
Because he doesn't know he's there or where he's going to come from, I think is why that's happening. But definitely poorly done by him, don't get me wrong.
For sure.
You want to talk about, like, you want to talk more about analysis of the game and, like, how things were on open play, or is it just sort of not that interesting on this occasion, what do you think?
I think it is really interesting because I did think we got it together. The first 15 minutes, I mean, I was like, I had no hope before this game at all.
Okay.
Like, my expectations were on the floor. I posted in my family WhatsApp group that I was really worried about a heavy loss. And that's nothing more than just we're in a bad place at the moment. Arsenal are in an incredible place. Like the vibes going into the game were not good. I know that everything kind of goes out the window, as they say, for a North London derby. And also that tactically it was a better matchup for us than some of our previous games. But I just had a bad feeling. And the first 15 minutes of the game were really heartening to me. I watched those and I thought, this is Ange Ball. Like, we've shown up. The players seem motivated. I saw Ben Davis clatter into Saka a couple of times, really aggressive. I thought we played through midfield quite effectively. Yeah. I thought Højbjerg was controlling things. I thought Bentancur had a good start to the game. You know, Werner and Kulusevski were having some decent touches. And I felt okay. And Gary Neville was saying, you know, Spurs are looking the better side here. And then suddenly we're 1-0 down. And I just felt like one step forward, two steps back is the easiest metaphor, I think. You know, we worked ourselves into a position of growing in confidence. We've had a rough few weeks, and yet it felt like the players were clicking. It felt like Ange Ball, how it was being played early in the season, it felt like it was connecting again. And then we throw a goal away needlessly, in my opinion, and it felt very frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, coming into this game, my focus was on our possession game, sort of reacting emotionally to the Newcastle game because I've been very steadfast all season. Like, our possession play is our biggest strength. Playing from the back is incredible. When teams come to press us, it only hurts them. And then Newcastle flipped the script on that. I did a video about how we can adapt to that, and also sort of said also, like, Arsenal don't press in an enormously different way to this, and that's a bit spooky. But in truth, Arsenal allow the first pass out to the centre-back and even sometimes allow the second pass from the centre-back. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you allow Spurs to do that, you know,
we're too good.
We did well. So I think we outplayed them through midfield for most of the game. Mm-hmm. Not so much in the 45 to sort of 60th minute of the game. That was pretty rough. But yeah, for the most part, I thought we were a better team from open play. Now, don't get me wrong, because, like, we didn't turn that into a huge number of great chances, right? Arsenal defending in their own third are as good as any other team going at the moment, unfortunately. And mm-hmm. we are struggling in those situations. We did okay. We churned out some minor chances. In the end, we probably should have generated two penalties from the threat we put into their box from open play. Obviously, only got one of them. But I think defensively, we massively nullified Arsenal. They essentially had one chance from open play, which Saka scored isolated against Ben Davies. In my opinion, and the opinion of just about every Spurs fan, that chance should never have existed because there should have been a penalty awarded down the other end. Obviously, there's a context here. There's game state, right? Arsenal didn't have to push themselves in open play. They didn't have to come out their own third because they were, you know, getting a goal every other corner, right? But I still think, you know, they would like to have fucking got something out of their counterattack. So I do think we deserve some credit there.
Not just that. They were panicking possession.
Yeah.
Because our our pressing was aggressive and effective. We won the ball back plenty in their half. Well, this is, I mean, it led to a goal on one occasion.
Sorry, so. This is the point I meant to set up earlier when I was talking about our possession game. Like, we've sort of barely been able to see our pressing game over the last several weeks, but like, we're a good pressing side. Yeah.
Yeah.
Teams aren't generally trying to have the ball against us a lot the last few weeks, but yeah, our pressing game was really strong, and you're right. Romero's goal. Shout out to Romero for popping up there.
Oh my god. He was incredible in this game.
Yeah, our pressing game, really impressive in this game. But easy to overlook that given the result and the obviously the disappointment surrounding that because of the context of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean I was floored when Arsenal scored their first goal, you know, Here we go again. But actually I thought despite being 1-0 down, we carried on playing our game. We were doing it really effectively. And in my opinion, Kulusevski wins a Stonewall penalty. And these fouls frustrate the hell out of me because anyone who has ever played any team sport knows that that is a foul. Anyone who's ever played a sport where you're running and someone clips your heel knows that that is a foul. And yet they so often don't get given because it looks like the player trips himself up. It looks like the player just kind of falls over. But when you're running at speed and with focus and determination to make that next step, being knocked off your stride pattern will floor you. And Kulusevski, unfortunately, is bad at diving. And he tried to stay on his feet. He tried to maintain possession. And then he had to go to ground because it was too much. His momentum was, he was kind of, his body weight had shifted and he was in the wrong position to maintain his balance. And the way that the VAR thresholds are set mean that that is never going to get overturned because for some reason it's not enough of a mistake to justify that, even though it's a penalty. It's a foul and therefore a penalty. So that is a huge mistake and should be rectified. Or at least Michael Oliver should be sent over to the screen to have a look. And if he wants to stand by his original decision, then, you know, good luck to him.
Oh, yeah.
But he should be sent over there.
Apparently, at halftime, the NBC, halftime host people said that apparently the VAR asked Oliver to go and look at his monitor and he didn't. I haven't had that reported anywhere else.
I saw that someone screenshotted it from Reddit. I would be astonished if that were the case, because with referees under this much scrutiny and with tapes being released of VAR discussions, like, why would Michael Oliver refuse to go and take a look
release
at the screen?
Release the tapes.
Yeah.
We demand a replay.
Yeah. I mean,
but Bardi being in the stadium and seeing that incident happen, you know, Kulusevski goes to ground, there's a check happening, and then suddenly Arsenal are broken and Saka's one-on-one with Ben Davies. Like, what are the emotions you go through in that moment?
I mean, first of all, I'm happy that you two are took some positivity from this, but I do feel that was like seven goals in a row that we've conceded in games where we've had control and managed. We seem to have, other than the scoreline, we've seemed to have managed, and that's the issue that I've had with Pochettino, with Postecoglou, and that's something which is still alarm bells ringing for me. The ease in which teams score against us. I thought perhaps it should have been a penalty. Well, it looks like it should have been a penalty. From where I was, you couldn't see it, but you know, we would claim everything in the stadium at that moment. But then they just passed through our counter press like it wasn't even there, and then before you know it, it's one-on-one. And I don't blame Davies. You know, Saka's very good in those positions and he finishes nicely, and we're constantly putting our defenders in one-on-one situations, and for the most part Van de Ven handles it quite nicely, and he did that in the second half many times. He just gobbled up Martinelli and Havertz, and that's good. But it's like when it really matters, other teams get the better of us. And I think Arsenal just allowed us to have the ball. They just, every 15 minutes they'd scored a goal, and then they were just like, okay, we're 3-0 up now. And it was only Arsenal doing an Arsenal, almost bottling it, that got us back into that game, because they lost their minds and started to panic. And I don't take as much comfort from this game as you two do, because Arsenal knew they could just let us have the ball when we were never really going to hurt them. It was a stupid mistake from their goalkeeper and a stupid mistake from, who was it, Rice maybe. And I think that's where the problem is with Tottenham. Teams, they know how to beat us now. And every time we've played a half-decent team in the last couple of months, apart from Villa, which is the outlier of all of this, they've done a number on us. And that's the worry for me, that good, we're playing front foot football, but an exciting football, and everybody seems to be happy, but it's not the results. And I know perhaps results don't matter, and we're taking this kind of philosophical approach to football that it doesn't matter now. All we care about is vibes and progress, but progress is nothing without results. And he'll get himself sacked if this keeps happening, and he'll be fired before Christmas if we keep getting battered like this. And that's the truth of it. Postecoglou can keep going about everything else, but he will get fired if this continues to happen.
I don't think losing 3-2 to Arsenal is a battering, firstly. I just don't. I think the Newcastle game...
It wasn't a close 3-2, yes, man. It wasn't a back and forth 3-2.
Well, we won on XG. So, like, we had the better of it in terms of the chances, the possession, the corners, the shots. Like, we dominated the game in all the metrics.
Saka missed an open goal.
I'm not saying
Vicario made an insane save from Saka, like an incredible save. And they had a goal disallowed for offside as well, which was a warning sign. But Vicario made an incredible save. We didn't create a chance that good the whole game.
I think you're mischaracterizing this game. I mean, I agree with your general point that this, like, yeah, absolutely, this can't continue. Like, Ange will not last if he keeps losing games every time he comes up against a good team. That's true. And also, if we keep shooting ourselves in the foot by conceding set pieces, like, we don't have enough yet to come back from that.
Yeah.
So we will keep losing goals, losing games, and he will get sacked. Having said that, I do come away from this game feeling quite positive overall. So let me read out a few of the emails, because we got several that were wanting to remain positive and sort of take the good from this game, because there was lots of good. So Jack Lane said, I'm feeling motivated to write in today to hopefully give a bit of a positive spin on things. For me, the margins were so fine in this game, and 3-0 flattered Arsenal significantly at halftime. We hit the post, were inches offside for an equaliser, and dominated the ball. Then we nearly staged a memorable comeback against a top team in the second half. It's a shame it wasn't to be, but Arsenal are deep into their project and we're in our first phase. Alarmingly for me, I feel like there's an anti-Ange sentiment stirring in the fan base at the moment. There's a narrative that Ange is willfully ignoring the set-piece problem, and I think this is egregiously unfair on him. For a start, we went pretty much half of our season being perceived as one of the strongest in this area. Mina Jedernak has been our defensive coach all season, and until game week 18 against Everton in December, I don't believe we conceded a single goal from a corner. From memory, it wasn't really an issue again until Everton came back on the 3rd of February. Then other teams started targeting Vicario in particular. And yet I see people asking, why haven't we got a defensive set-piece coach? Realistically, why would Ange undermine Jedernak mid-season without giving him a chance to resolve the problem? It would potentially disrupt the environment behind the scenes for the sake of an issue that has only come up fairly recently. That just seems counterproductive to me. It's obviously an issue, and Ange must be aware of it, but in my opinion, it's not poor management to see if Jedernak can find solutions and then reassess whether players and coaches need improvement next season. I wouldn't be surprised if Jedernak is replaced, to be honest. Can we all just calm down and allow this great man some time to develop a team? He gives us so much to be excited about. Harry Tateson Stokes said, it wasn't that bad. I'm sending this immediately post full time. And while we take into account Ange's decision to not have a dedicated set piece coach as a mistake, the calls at the first half performance overall was naive and we were run ragged is nonsense. If the officials could do their job, we'd have been 1-1. We hit the post. Romero had another big chance. It's easy to let the result determine your views and performance, especially in North London derby. But whilst it wasn't perfect, it wasn't that bad. Bardi, do you think these people are delusional?
No, I don't think they're delusional, and I think it's good to be positive and have hope that things can change. I want things to change. I would love it if we start doing amazing things, but I'm just concerned that there's a pattern coming, and that's my concern. I'm worried. I'm worried about where things are going with us right now, because we've got some massive games coming up. We've got Chelsea, Liverpool, and City. And what if we lose all of them? What's that? That's that 5 losses on the bounce. Like, it's a serious situation we have here. This is a critical point, because momentum means everything. And finishing the season in a positive manner will do great things for us in terms of the club and the fan base. But if we finish the season with a draw against Burnley and then defeats in the rest of our games, that's a terrible way to finish. That's like 90s football end of year stuff, and it's not a good place to be. It's not a good place to be in.
Yeah, I agree, and I think you know, I've watched a bit of Chelsea and Liverpool recently. I think both of them are beatable. I think so. We've got two away games, Chelsea and Liverpool. That's like in itself the fact that they're back-to-back away against teams that we historically have struggled to win against is tough. But those teams are beatable at the moment. Liverpool are completely deflated with little to play for, and Salah is massively underperforming, and Chelsea are an inconsistent mess at the moment. So I would be really disappointed if we lost both of those games. Really, really disappointed. Then we've got Burnley, City and Sheffield United to end the season. Now, like you say, if we finish this season having lost three or four of those, then yes, there are alarm bells. But I don't think that will be the case. I feel more optimistic after the Arsenal game than I did before. Nathan, where are you?
I don't agree with that last statement, personally. I understand your perspective. I emotionally feel awful about potentially failing to prevent Arsenal from winning the league, right? And that overrides
sucks.
The analysis of things. I just, so referencing Alistair Gold again, he did a poll the other day. This is before the Arsenal game, but it is after the 4-0 loss to Newcastle, right? He says, based on your pre-season expectations, what's happened since and what you've seen, has Ange Postecoglou's first campaign in charge of Tottenham been a success at this point? And that 92% of responses are yes, it's been a positive season, it's been a successful season. So I just want to establish that, that there certainly isn't a significant split down the fan base on this. I don't feel great about this run that we've got. I want us to lose to City for reasons explained, which is a horrible position to be in, but that's just the reality of things. I don't feel great about our chances from getting fantastic results to see the season out, and I think we might. What's the table looking like? What are we? So we're 6 points above United, Dan. What are they doing there? They're so bad. And 7 points above Newcastle. So I doubt we're going to slide very far, but it's going to be tough to get fourth now, I think, with the run-in that we have. But aside from the fact that I would much prefer City to win the league than Arsenal, I sort of don't care about this season. I'm already thinking summer. I'm already thinking next season. That's where my thoughts are at this stage with that game done. And again, in the long term, I feel really good. And I kind of just can't wait for the season to be over so we can get, you know, rebuilding the squad.
And I understand that. I understand the positivity around it because we were in such a bad place. So wherever we finish this season, it's been an improvement on where we were towards the end of last season. So that's always a positive. But 100%. You are allowed to change expectations halfway through because none of us foresaw what would happen to Chelsea and Man United and just to the kind of, and Newcastle, that most of last season's top, half of last season's top four would just fall apart. So I think after the start we had, we changed our perspective and we thought top four would have been a good, was kind of par for us for this season, but it hasn't happened. So we're allowed to be disappointed, but on the whole, is it better than last season? Of course it is, man. Everything's better than what we had last season, but I still think we're right to be disappointed and there is questions to be addressed and things that need sorting out because it's not been great these last couple of months.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
If you're a long-time listener, you might know I've been drinking AG1 for quite some time now. In life, there are many things you can't control. Things that happen, no matter how hard you try, you simply can't prevent. Things like Spurs getting smashed in the North London derby or other life events. That's why it's important to make sure where you can have an impact, you seize control. Attack those areas like a boss. Seize control of your diet and your vitamin intake. Reach for that AG1 scoop every morning. Go and get it. Don't be reactive with your health and supplements. Don't wait for something to happen or allow yourself to be bullied. Be positive. Be truly front-footed. Don't just be a soundbite. I trust my AG1 to help support me and my choices. I just wish that sometimes my team that I support was equally as obliging. Take control of what you can and don't worry so much about them lot. Drink AG1. Be better, mate.
If there's one product we had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why we partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/extrainch. That's drinkag1.com/extrainch. Check it out. So, in amongst the chaos of Sunday's North London Derby, we had some interesting individual performances. I think the one that has caught most people's eye was James Maddison's. I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion about Maddison and his performances post-recovery from injury. And so we heard some murmurings in the week that maybe James Maddison is actually carrying another injury and has been all the time, all along, which is hampering him. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that is accurate, but it would sure make sense if it were true, because at the moment he looks like he's not fully committing to things. He looks as though he isn't moving freely. He looks as though he is getting frustrated constantly on the pitch, which comes out in a myriad of different ways, which negatively affects both his own performance and that of those around him. And to be honest, I don't think he should be starting at the moment. I think he's been very fortunate to be in the starting 11 for the last few games. And he got taken off after about 60 minutes, I think, in this match, which felt right. But like, he could have easily been taken off at halftime.
I agree with you. I think he's been way off the mark for quite some time. He's going into areas where previously he would get the ball and just move out of it and carry the ball. I can't remember the last time he's carried the ball or he's gone past the player. His passing has slowed down. There's definitely something up with him. It's not the Maddison that we were so in love with early on in the season. I did see a tweet from a Leicester fan saying this is classic James Maddison. His season, you can always split into thirds. Excellent, injured, non-existent. And I think that's perhaps, you know, like an ex-girlfriend, ex-boyfriend being a bit angry at being jilted. But I do think there is something to that. He has disappeared. And if he is holding an injury and he's waiting for the Euros, you know, personally, I would like to see him just miss the Euros. And I don't even think he should get in the team with the way he's playing at the moment anyway, but just do the surgery or whatever it needs to be and get better, because we can't carry him. And I would like to see Kulusevski start or Lo Celso start right now.
Yeah, I because previously I've been defending Maddison's performances and saying I think the issue is our overall play and our service to him, but I think it was more evident in this game, and good timing with the information there, that it makes sense that he's not at full fitness, not at full intensity. Him being subbed off at 60 minutes coincides with us suddenly massively stepping up our intensity in this game. And obviously you're going to get that from subs anyway. The moment he goes off, we immediately surprise Arsenal with our press and Romero wins the ball high for his goal. An overall, a high level means like the problem isn't Maddison's capability or as a player, in my opinion, that he's carrying this injury. He won't be injured forever. Therefore, we don't need to be concerned long-term about Maddison, but it does make sense that, yeah, right now it's massively affecting his play. Football has such a massive problem with players carrying injuries that need attention and need surgery. And we saw this with Richarlison for long, long periods of time and taking them into international tournaments. Like, what's Maddison even going to play for England? Like, especially on the form that you're rightly, you know, all fucking limping around for months to get like one game off the bench in the group stage for England. Like, what's it worth, man? You know, in a squad that's got Foden and Palmer and Grealish or whatever, what are you hoping for? him getting meaningful game time for England means that he only comes when he's playing his best, and him playing at the best means that he's got to be fully fit or as close to as you can reasonably get. So that's really frustrating. Similarly frustrating is if it's true that he's been injured since like way back before November, that we've seen so little of Lo Celso, and that we've seen as little as we have of Kulusevski in central areas. Acknowledging that Kulusevski has struggled moving into a central area off the bench, but then in this game you saw him move central from having started on the wing, and that seems to suit him better because he's already within the rhythm of the game or whatever. I guess maybe there are other contexts there, but yeah, this is frustrating. The big upside again is that I don't think this is just who Maddison is. The problem is, and I'm really sorry to do this because I know how annoying it is, I know why Maddison struggled with consistency at Leicester, and I'm not allowed to divulge that information ethically, and I know that it's a non-concern now. I've already kind of put myself in an awkward position.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of what happened before, what we've seen this season from Maddison has been disappointing to the extreme, because he was so good at the start of the year. I mean, this signing made
incredible.
So much sense. Like, he just fits into Spurs like a glove. It seems like this is where he's meant to be. And you just want to see those levels, and they've not been there. Whereas, I thought Kulusevski had a really, really strong game. I mean, I've personally stuck with Kulusevski across this season. I think he has become an underrated player for Spurs, and his hold-up play is much needed at the moment. I thought he did a great job. I really liked him in the middle. I liked it when he kind of drifted over to the right to join in with Johnson and have some kind of link up. And then, I just thought he was creative and sparky and helped us retain the ball in the final third. I want to talk a little about Son, though, because as much as I think Maddison has struggled to perform, I think Son struggled possibly even more. All the caveats apply. Best finisher in the world, maybe. Club captain, love him to pieces, wonderful human being, great professional on and off the pitch, someone you are proud to have as your captain.
Can't trap a ball to save his life.
The ball just bounces off him sometimes, and it frustrates the hell out of me. And the thing is, like, as much as I love Son representing the club and being like club captain, I do think it hinders Ange's ability to take him off. I think it's factoring in, because like when he moved left, he received the ball to feet several times and had an opportunity to go at his man, and he didn't. He turned and passed back three or four times. I don't think, like, we saw Manuel Solomon do that earlier in the season, and he got dropped for it or kind of got displaced for it. Son has continually had a poor first touch or failed to deliver and just gets picked week on week on week on week. And Son has these patches every year, and he always comes back from them. Like, he will always finish the season with outstanding numbers, absolutely outstanding numbers. And so I get why you want to keep him in there. But we're at a point now where the team isn't connecting for whatever reason, or hasn't been connecting, and your central striker isn't delivering. And now Richarlison is back from injury. I think Richarlison has to start next game, and I think that's at the expense of Son. So it appears that Werner's done his hamstring. I'd be looking at playing Johnson, Lo Celso, Kulusevski behind Richarlison for the Chelsea game on Thursday. I don't think Maddison and Son deserve to start on current form.
I agree.
Does that mean starting Kulusevski central?
No, I think Lo Celso and Kulusevski wide right, because there's no other option with Werner being out.
Oh, of course, Werner's out. Yeah.
Let's assume Werner's out, because it looked like he certainly hurt his hamstring and pulled up, and it didn't look great.
I've been critical of Kulusevski as a wide man this season, but I did think we looked better with him inside. He may not have the kind of finesse that peak Maddison has, but right now he's got the kind of industry and movement that Maddison doesn't have. I also think, to be fair to Maddison, to kind of like support him a little bit, the decline in Bissouma hasn't helped his game either. I think that's had an impact, and it's almost like we keep rotating our midfield three now because Postecoglou's clearly not happy with, well, keep rotating the other two in our midfield three because he's clearly not happy with how they're functioning. So I think that's the kind of big problem that we need to solve quickly as well.
What do you think, Nathan? Where are you on Son? I know you've stood by him because of the numbers that he produces year on year, game on game.
When Ange was first coming in, I was very early to say Son's going to be our number nine. This is a perfect role for him. And that's because watched a bunch of Celtic and watched some Yokohama and said, oh, look, the number nine exists just to put the ball in the net. And that's what Son is best at. And all his weaknesses are irrelevant. And I felt that way for most of the season also, that if we're failing to... If Son is not putting the ball in the net, the problems are coming elsewhere. I still think that's mainly true. But perhaps that style of football where you spend most of the time playing with 10 men is not suited to being Spurs in the most competitive league in the world. Perhaps we need more from our number nine. But then, like, you look at the way City use Haaland, I guess you can look at it both ways and say, well, City won the treble with Haaland. Also, maybe Haaland is undermining them now that they're not perfect this season, right? So it goes both ways. It's a risk like any other selection of football. If you're just going to have a number nine that's just there for goals and doesn't do much else, there are upsides and downsides. I'd be curious to see next season how Son looks if we are, you know, if we have a 1v1 specialist on the wing. And we have depth through the back so that our build-up play remains consistent all season, things like that. The other thing with that on Son and our use of him is a lot of the season, when I've been talking about 1v1 specialists, I've mainly focused on someone to play on the left because, I guess I don't really know why, because Kulusevski, but then that doesn't really stand up to time. So, I mean, I've mainly been looking at both siders, but in my head, it's kind of been a left-sided player. But I think that we don't desperately, I suspect, need both our wide players to be absolute monsters with the ball to feet. So I think that if we had a player on the right wing, be that Nico Williams or whoever, that then the opposite side would be more suited to someone who was a wide forward, as it were. And therefore, I could see a role for Sonny shared with Werner next season on the left, with the two of them being slightly more, wide forwards, and the right winger being someone putting up 5+ successful dribbles to the byline every game. And therefore, that left winger becomes more about their off-ball movement. If that were the case, we would see Werner miss a few sitters next season, I suspect.
So on Werner, I've actually had a complete 180 on whether we sign him. I've been adamant that we sign Timo Werner because I've just been like, you know, you can't get that skill set at that high level for that price elsewhere.
Yeah.
And he's now settled, established, and knows the squad. He seems like a really good guy, like good in the dressing room, et cetera, and then I went back to looking at our squad for next year, and I did a podcast about the squad building and the homegrown requirements. I did. And basically, I don't think we can sign Timo Werner, if I'm honest, and do the other business that we need to do. I think there's too much required from the signings we need to make. And I think if we were to sign him as another non-homegrown player, I think he basically becomes the Manuel Solomon of next season, like the player that blocks another potential more helpful player in a position of need. And that concerns me. I think I agree with you that I want to see Son play wide a bit more next year. For me, the ideal would be some more multifaceted players that can play multiple positions. So Eze is of particular interest to me at the moment because he can play on the left or he can play centrally. And I think that would be really helpful. I think that would leave us with a quite nice combination of wingers if we were to have Eze, Johnson, Son, Kulusevski.
Hiroki Ito can play left centre-back and left-back. Gitrauda can play all the way across the back four and number six. Kyle Walker-Peters is homegrown, club-trained, and can play left-back and right-back, although he can't defend.
Right, it did fit right in.
What I need... Cheers, buddy. What I want your help with, Wendy, is raw numbers, right? So let's propose for me an example in which we offload the players we need to offload, whether that's loan or sale or burning their contract or whatever, right? And Ndombele gone, Hill gone, Solomon gone, all of the 17 non-homegrown players that we would reasonably get rid of. Let's say, for example, in this situation, we keep Højbjerg because he's a 50-50 case or a zero case in Barty's opinion. How many spaces do I have to fill with players that I like that aren't homegrown?
So, sorry, you're keeping Højbjerg?
Yeah, I think so.
What are you doing with Lo Celso?
Shit.
He's getting a new contract, isn't he? That's my idea.
According to some random Spanish source. Oh, you're right. Okay.
What are you doing with Skip?
He's homegrown, right? So he's not a huge factor in this position?
Not for the Premier League, but he is. Skip's not a problem for the Champions League because he's club trained as well.
I'm probably sending Skip, but I don't think it's a factor here.
Okay, cool. So if we sell. Yep. Højbjerg, Lo Celso, Reguilón, Ndombele, Roden, Whiteman, Royal, Tanganga, Solomon, Sessegnon, Spence, Skip, Hill, and Robertson.
God.
Then we can sign four. Then we can sign four non-homegrown players.
So if I keep Højbjerg, I'm down to three. If I keep Lo Celso, I'm down to two.
Yeah. So Werner, sorry, I've included Werner. Yeah, so you could actually Werner. Do five. You could do five.
Okay.
Non-homegrown players. If you sell all those players, the thing is, we're not going to sell all those players.
We might loan the others out successfully, or
we might do. The chances are, though, that one or two of those will be in the squad next year. And the thing is, if they're there, you name them in the Premier League squad, because like not doing so is it's so wasteful. So I reckon like maybe Lo Celso or Højbjerg stay. Maybe I don't know. Royal stays, and it restricts you further. You can, however, you've got a couple of spaces for homegrown signings if you sell Skip, Sessegnon, Spence,
yes,
Tanganga.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I think that's workable.
So you're still keeping Werner?
Yeah. And I still get to bring in a 1v1 specialist that isn't homegrown and a left footed defender that isn't homegrown. And then it gets more complicated with the fullbacks. I think you've got to bring Carl Peters in if you're going to, that's tough.
Yeah. So what you've done there is the mistake I initially made, in my opinion. There is a mistake, that is. Because I think now we have to accept that we don't just need to sign some homegrown players. We need to sign some players who are strong in the air because we don't have that strength elsewhere in our squad. And therefore, I think you almost have to rule Walker Peters out on the grounds that he's not good in the air, or you don't sign Werner because he's not good in the air. Like you have to factor these, like the situation we've put ourselves in for this summer with the way we've managed the homegrown situation and not developed our own youth players. Not that they have to be homegrown, but they could back up. They could create depth in the squad.
None of them can jump, with me, to be fair.
I've seen Alfie Durrington jump. I've seen several of our young players. Like Will Lancashire is really strong in the air. But yeah, like I think there's a lot to do. I think it's a tough ask for our recruitment team to hit all those marks in the summer and sell all these players that we don't want anymore.
Talking about selling, I know I'm the kind of co-president of the Sell Sun fan club, but he has had his third most fruitful season at Spurs since he's been here. And I think he's more than likely to score one or two more goals, which will make this his second most fruitful season at Spurs. So I do think, as much as I like to blame Sun and say we should have sold him for the money to invest elsewhere, I think he's had an okay season. And I wouldn't pin our attacking problems on him. I think it's more the system and the players around him that's let him down. When the systems work, Son has scored goals.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I agree with that as well. Certainly the final statement. But at the moment, I mean, I would love to see what would happen if Richarlison played through the middle.
Yeah.
And Son was either wide or on the bench in the next game. I think we'll be better for
it. What Son can't do is kind of manipulate a game to build it around him the same way Kane could just do something physically and had the physical presence to shift a game. And some forwards have that. They just that ability to kind of just make the whole game rotate around them. Almost like the way Romero did when he went gallivanting up front. The sheer physical presence just all of a sudden changed the dynamic of the match. That's what Son doesn't have, but he still remains a good player, but yeah, we should still sell him.
So So Ange was full of praise for Romero post-match. He made a comment along the lines of, like, if only the others had a bit of what Romero's got. It was that kind of thing. And my friend Mushtaka sent me a message saying Romero should be our captain. And I found it hard to disagree. And one of the I have just said how much it's amazing to have Son Heung-min leading our club as captain. I think he's an incredible role model and leader. But I do think there's a case that Romero should be joint captain now, partly because I think it would enable us to leave Son on the bench more, which I think would be a good thing for us and a good thing for him. But also, Romero has, I think, shown a really impressive ability to learn and adapt and change. He was rash in the first half of the season, and he got punished for it, and we got punished for it. And he's barely put a foot wrong since that Chelsea game. He's been extremely well behaved. And I've been really impressed, really, really impressed by how he's handled himself. And I think his leadership qualities on the pitch in the Arsenal game were there for all to see. He stepped up. What do you reckon, Nathan? Do you think there's any argument that Romero should be a joint captain next year?
I don't think it matters. I think that if he is our natural leader, he will naturally lead. And that's it. That's all that.
And you dispute the idea that Son plays because he's captain?
No, because this was true under Conte. This was true under Mourinho when he had rough patches of form then. It didn't matter that Son wasn't captain then. He was still Son. He's still a megastar. He's still the best finisher in the game going. And he couldn't be benched for that reason. Except, of course, actually, I think he can be benched in all those scenarios. So I don't think the captaincy is a huge relevant...
But he hasn't been, is the thing. And there are other options. We'll see over the coming
You
games.
Can't take a captaincy off somebody for having a bad run of form.
I'm not saying that we should strip some of the captaincy. Yeah, exactly. I think that it would more be promoting Romero than
that's still
Son.
Demoting. That's still
if we have joint vice captains.
That's still a demotion of Son. I think Son as captain is fine. Romero's vice captain is fine. You can have a kind of captain and then also a leader, a presence on the pitch. The armband is a formality. It's a piece of admin. I don't think it matters that much. I think once again, people perhaps going back to the old captain needs to be this chest dumping, massive brute of a man that kicks players into the air. I don't think that's really it. I think Son has led us pretty well this season, and he's done a good job at captaining us. And I think it would be really, really harsh on him to kind of downgrade his captaincy.
Just want to finally acknowledge that Mikey Moore was there with the first team squad, as he has been for the last 2 weeks, training up. So I found this really interesting. It's something we haven't done since, I think, Harry Winks, when he was fast-tracked from the under-18s to the first team under AVB, I think. And he basically bypassed the under-21s at that point, straight from the under-18s to the first team. This is what's happened with Mikey Moore. He's barely played for the under-21s. He played 45 minutes across two games last season, nothing this year. I watched the under-18s 2 weeks ago, where Mikey Moore tried to do everything himself. He refused to pass the teammates in better positions because he's Mikey Moore and he can do it all. And the thing is, he can. He's brilliant. He's a ridiculous player. And I watched that game and I thought, oh, okay, yeah, that explains why he's not in the under-21s, because he doesn't appreciate his teammates yet. And then lo and behold, the following Monday, he's training with the first team. So what do I know? But sounds like he's held his own in first team training. Again, he's brilliant. Of course he would. And I'm really pleased that Ange is taking some sort of interest in our youth players, because it's been a big criticism of mine of Ange this season. So I think that can only be a good thing.
Can you, maybe this isn't the episode for it, very quickly, if he's maybe good enough to be playing for the senior team, why is he in the under-18s and not in the under-21s?
So there is one argument that he was with the seniors to show that you have to appreciate teammates. You like allow him to be a small fish in a big pond for a while and see how he handles
that.
Or it could be part of his contract. Like, apparently we had to move mountains to make sure that he joined us as a scholar and not other teams. We did things that we don't normally do,
okay,
in terms of the money and the promises.
All right, so then put aside his little work experience this week, why is he, if he's too good for the under-18s, why is he not in the under-21s?
I really don't know. Okay,
fine. Good enough.
It could be just that they want to prioritise other players in under-21s to give them the minutes, right, because they aren't sure on them either way. Plus, their under-21s have just won the PL2, so
clearly good enough,
they're doing pretty well without him.
You have been listening to The Extra Inch with me, Windy, my sidekick and best friend, Barney, and our tactics guy, Nathan Aklar. If you like this, there's plenty more at patreon.com/TheExtraInch. Production is by Nathan A. Clark. Our logo, artwork and website are designed by Creighton Miller. Our music is by David Lindmer. You can find him on Instagram at David Lindmer. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us at podcast@theextrainch.co.uk. Subscribe, leave us a rating and a review. And most importantly, be sure to tell all of your Spurs friends. Shout out to the ex-subs. We love every single last one of you. And of course, come on you Spurs.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.